Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. What happened to the art of the deal? For the past 33 days of the partial federal government shutdown, there's been no deal and no end in sight. Even if the president and Democratic leaders sit down to talk it out, what might that negotiation look like? What does the art of negotiation really mean? Well, joining me to talk about this are two people who know quite a bit about negotiating: David Harrington, CEO and president of the Prince George's County Chamber of Commerce, and A. Scott Bolden, criminal defense attorney and former chair of the National Bar Association. We're talking about it tonight. What do you think about a negotiation between the president and Nancy Pelosi? What should be said? What's the give and take? Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Scott, Dave, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it. Before I get to you guys, I want to play something from D.C.'s Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. I spoke to her today, and I asked her specifically about negotiation between the president and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. And this is what she shared with me.
That we have the upper hand, and I just hope we don't lose it, because the polls show people want the government open. We could lose it if this goes on for too long. So my advice to my own people is, watch out, don't play your hand too strong. We've got to find a way to open this government. We've been passing continuing resolutions that would open the government until a certain period. I think that needs to be emphasized more, Harold. We have been passing resolutions that say open the government for a couple of weeks. Now, he has not taken that. And you would ask, well, why not? Because he could always close it again. I think the reason he hasn't taken that is because he's keeping the government closed, because he thinks that's the only leverage he has.
Scott, I'll have you react to what Congresswoman Norton shared with us. Your thoughts.
Well, I think the Congresswoman is right that the Democrats have the upper hand. You know, in any negotiation, and over 30 years of practice in law, I've settled disputes in the criminal courts, civil courts, as president of the Chamber of Commerce in D.C., as well as chair of the D.C. Democratic Party. You need three things. One, both sides need credibility. Two, you have to be willing and wanting to settle. And thirdly, you certainly have to be willing to compromise. Now here, credibility on the part of Donald Trump is waning, and he has a real problem with the relationship with the truth. Secondly, he owned this shutdown. He announced it. He said he wouldn't charge or blame the Democrats. He certainly has. And he said Mexico would pay for the wall. Now, all of this is on videotape. It's not a money issue or compromise issue, unfortunately, for the country, because but for the wall, the government would be open. The Democrats don't want to give him the wall, not for political purposes. You could say that. But the reality is the empirical data that supports whether a wall would be effective or not certainly doesn't hold up. Drugs, crime, and illegal immigrants. You know, most of those illegal immigrants coming through drugs and crime, they simply are coming through legal ports of entry.
Yeah. And I don't want to get too far afield of that, because I do want to focus on the negotiation piece. And I want, you know, Dave, you were nodding your head when Congresswoman Norton was speaking. What were your thoughts about that?
No, I think the Congresswoman is absolutely right. That while the polls show that the president is losing the argument, there's a point we're getting to now the second paycheck for many of these employees. And there's going to be a point where folks are going to say, look, just settle this. I'm sure Scott can appreciate this. There's a point where the temperature is raised so high and the sacrifice becomes unbearable that people just say, look, let's end this right now. And so I think in negotiations, you have to then the point where you have to identify the playing field, right? And the playing field is the government. So shutting down the government doesn't allow for the negotiations to happen. And so that's why you saw the president get on television. He says, well, this is my proposal, but you're not having the give and take of that proposal in the place where it's supposed to happen. And that is in the Congress. And then, of course, as Scott noted, that you have to compromise.
And David, if I may.
Go ahead, Scott.
Normally that would be the case and I would agree with you, but here, the wall is an issue and it's a non-starter. And if the other side tells you it's a non-starter and all you do is keep coming back to this wall and you're not willing to compromise, then it ends up that wall in and of itself, you're not really compromising. And it's not good negotiation. It's being hard-headed about it. And the president's not going to give up this wall while the Democrats continue to pass resolutions to open the government. So let's say you missed two checks, three checks, right? Nobody wants that. But the Democrats aren't going to really be – the kitchen doesn't – or the stove doesn't get hot for the Democrats, I don't think, because they can just hold up every resolution to open up the government. And but for Mitch McConnell and but for President Trump, these workers would be back at work. It's going to be hard to blame directly the Democrats. Now, they may be mad at everyone else, but the Democrats have a great response. And the other thing is this. What does closing the government, over the wall have to do with closing EPA or parts of DOJ or any, or Department of Interior? It borders on the nonsensical and it's illogical. And as long as it borders on that, this president is going to suffer from it and those workers are going to suffer from it, not the Democrats.
And that brings me to my next point. And you touched on it, Scott, because we talked about the wall. We talked about the government shutdown. What are we missing here? Is this actually bigger than the wall when it comes to the issue of negotiating an end to this government shutdown? Is this about ego? Is this more about power and less about the shutdown and the wall? Scott first and then Dave.
Sure. Yeah, I think Donald Trump deeply believes in this wall, but he deeply believes in his political rhetoric, not political reality. There's no empirical data coming from his side, no incredible numbers that say this wall is going to stop anything. As a matter of fact, the numbers he uses in regard to terrorists and criminals that they've stopped from coming in aren't rooted on the southern border. They're rooted in overall all the borders, if you will. So the thousands of people that they've stopped, or terrorists or criminals or rapists or drugs, if you will, they've stopped that countrywide. But if you look at the actual numbers at the southern border, it'll show you that the drugs aren't coming in through the southern border. They're coming through legal ports. The illegal immigrants are coming here and overstaying legal visas, for example. And the terrorists on the southern border, they just haven't identified any. That's not me saying that. That's the Pew Trust saying that. That's DOS saying that. That's DHS saying that.
The State Department also saying the same. Yeah, Dave.
So, I certainly agree with Scott, but what I would also say is that in terms of negotiation, you have to come from reasonable and rational places, right? I don't know about whether or not, the president cares about the wall or he cares about having power and sees the presidency as wielding power. And I think that's part of the problem. This government was not set up for a kingship or authoritarian right. or totalitarian. It wasn't set up for that. It was set up for
base versus all Americans.
Right. It was set up for the Congress to have checks and balances with the executive in the way they pass laws. Mm-hmm. What I would say, who's at fault with this? And we had an event, the Chamber of Commerce had an event with Senator Van Hollen and Senator Cardin. And what we said was, and thanks to HUR for getting the word out there, but what we said was, let's put the onus on Leader McConnell, because the House passed the bill. In fact, the House passed the Senate bill that the Senate had passed before the House changed over,
mm-hmm.
they repassed that and sent it to the same place where it originally passed and said, okay, let's take an up and down vote. And so what I would say is, in terms of this negotiation, you have a process in place where you have a bill that both houses of Congress believed in and certainly voted on. Let's vote on that again, and then let's send that to the president. And the president can veto it. So that we really know the position of the president. Because all we're hearing is this kind of rhetoric. And the problem then with getting with rhetoric and going with falsehoods is that you can never negotiate in that kind of place.
Yeah.
So let's let the process happen. Let mm-hmm. the Senate vote up and down on the bill that the House passed. Send it to the president. If he vetoes it, then there's a process to override that veto. And let's put everybody in check on whether or not they want to open this government.
Hold on for a minute, Scott. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We're talking about the art of the deal. What has happened to the art of the deal, the art of negotiation, as we are now looking at a possible 34th day
right.
of this partial government shutdown. Let me go to the phone lines. Let's talk to Larry. Larry calling from Silver Spring. What's on your mind, Larry? Larry, go right ahead. Give us a call back, Larry, if you can. Let's go to Ivy calling from D.C. Ivy, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, thanks for having me. I think the Democrats have done a disservice to their constituency because they talk in sound bites, and they use those sound bites to form these or create a framework for these arguments that are not benefiting their constituents. And most importantly, when you look at Mr. Schumer and when you look at Ms. Pelosi, especially Mr. Schumer, you know, it's like the only thing they have a tendency to do is be clown themselves with absurd allegations instead of addressing the issues. It's very simple. At any point in time, they could go ahead and reopen the government and pass this bill to get these people back to work, because I'm a vendor of the government and it's disabling my organization, and just not appropriate the funds for the wall. It's just that simple.
Okay.
I mean,
Ivy, thank you so much for that. Real quick, Scott, is she correct?
Well, I think Schumer and Pelosi have passed the bill,
right.
As she's indicated.
Right.
But secondly, and most importantly, if you believe that caller's philosophy, giving the money for the wall, so I give you $5.7 billion for a wall that essentially is going to be a waste other than fulfilling a political promise. Why would the Dems or anybody else do that when the wall is not going to be effective and there's no evidence to support that? In fact, there's counter-evidence to it. So if I was to follow the caller, then that caller wants me, in the spirit of getting people back to work, they want me to spend $5.7 billion, which would be a complete waste of their tax dollars' money. I don't think the Democrats or anybody else in politics should do that with my money and my tax dollars.
Yeah, but I want to return to the point that I tried to make earlier, and that is that the bill passed. There was money for border security in that bill
mm-hmm.
that went to the House when the Republicans were in charge, and they didn't even take up the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the Democrats came in charge, and quite frankly, I think they did the responsible thing, they passed the same bill.
Mm-hmm.
There was money in there that the president asked for
mm-hmm.
that then went to the Senate, and then Leader McConnell said, well, we're not going to take up this vote. So I think that's a very important point
mm-hmm.
that and we in the chamber, we said, look, hashtag take the vote now.
Well, take the vote. The real boogeyman in all of
and,
this
because right.
he won't do his duty by being an equal co-member of the executive branch, the executive, legislative, and judicial, they're co-equal branches of government. He won't take up a bill and press the president to veto it and then have the votes to override it. He's washed his hands of it, almost conceding that if the president won't sign it, then the Senate's not going to act. And that's not a co-equal of branch. That's submitting to the executive branch and submitting to a president whose proposal for $5.7 million dollar or billion dollar wall simply makes no sense. And so the real boogeyman who's left, taking himself out of the negotiations and jumped back in now is really doing the president's bidding at the legislative level. And that's fundamentally wrong.
Let's talk about the negotiations after the break. What does that look like politically and even beyond the politics? Because both of you gentlemen know what is involved in negotiation. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to drill down a little bit, bit more on that in just a bit. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Lines are still open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Want to hear your thoughts about it. The original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR is next. We continue on SiriusXM in just a few seconds.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're talking about the art of negotiation in the midst of this partial federal government shutdown. What could possibly end it? What is the give and take between President Trump, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, of course, and the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell? I'm talking to two people who know quite a bit about negotiating. David Harrington, President and CEO of the Prince George's County Chamber of Commerce, and A. Scott Bolden, criminal defense attorney and former chair of the National Bar Association. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. So, Dave, you've been with the chamber for a while, but you were an elected official, not only with the Prince George's County Council, but you were also a state senator. Lot of negotiations there, particularly in Annapolis. What do you believe negotiations between the president and Pelosi and others should look like? What's the give and take? What's the language?
So the first thing, and when I was in the Senate and certainly had to negotiate in the House as well, is that you don't negotiate over the media or just with people who agree with you. You have to bring people who you know may have differences with you and how, and then work out those differences. And you come to the space where you work out those differences. So negotiation has to happen with everybody in the room. That's the first thing. The second thing is that, all right, you have to come to some agreement where these negotiations are going to happen. So that's why I stress that any negotiation has to happen with the government open, because then everyone in Congress has to be involved in taking and weighing in on what these look like. And many times with legislation, and Scott knows this, many times with legislation, you have amendments. And so people put amendments, those amendments are voted up and down, and then you move the bill in both houses. So I think the first thing that has to happen is, one, you have to say, okay, we're going to create the space where negotiations are going to happen in a way they're going to have decisions. And number two, that the different parties have to get together and submit proposals. Not one person getting in front of TV and say, this is my proposal, take it or leave it. Everybody has to come together and then work out a proposal that's going to open the government. And the third thing I would say is that the objective has to be open up the government. That's the objective. It's not about the wall. It's not about, it's about opening the government in a way where then, you know, people can get back to their livelihood, and there could be reasonable debate about how we conduct border security.
Scott, as a criminal defense attorney, is it similar for you, based on what Dave was just describing, when you are dealing with a defendant and prosecutors and trying to make a decision with that defendant that you are representing about how to move forward with charges and dropping charges, adding charges and the like?
Yeah, it's very similar, different platform. But what David's really talking about, for to happen is, one, make it a priority to get people back to work. Right. And that's not a priority of the president. At least it doesn't sound like it, because they can go back to work, just give me $5.7 billion for the wall. That's certainly not going to work. Secondly, if you talk about both parties and not going to the press and looking at comprehensive immigration reform, neither party seems to be interested in that, except let's get the workers back into these agencies. But what I see happening is this, okay? Because when you have this wall, you say it's not about the wall, or you can argue that, but ultimately it is. If you use the but-for test, but for this wall, these agencies wouldn't be closed. But for this wall, the government would be open. And when you go to the negotiation table like that, and you won't come off that wall piece, then the Democrats have to figure out, how do I give him something, if I'm going to give him something that looks and sounds and feels like something else, like border security, than the wall? Because the wall's just not going to work. And if the wall's not going to work, and he's a bully, if you will, he's a narcissist, if you will, and he's going to be stubborn about it to the detriment of this company, to the of this country, then you're looking at either he declares a national emergency, which he won't win in the courts, or he capitulates and gives up the wall and says that he's doing it because he can't stand to see these workers get a third or fourth paycheck, right? Or as you've seen him try, he said, "Give me the wall, but I'll give you DACA." But you see, right. He took away DACA.
Right.
You just giving them something back that they had already. That dog won't hunt. And so you can keep on talking and talking and talking. But one of the reasons they haven't been at the table is because there's no reason to go back to the table if the non-starter isn't removed from the table. And it's up to Trump to remove that wall. Maybe he legitimately gets border security with some fencing. I'm not talking about steel borders or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Or he comes up with some objective data to support how many people or how much this wall is going to stop drugs and illegal immigrants and terrorists from coming across the southern border. But he can't come up with that because his own data from his agencies belies that.
Okay.
And so I think ultimately Donald Trump is going to have to come off the wall because the Democrats aren't going to feel pressure, and they're continuing to try to open up the government from a political and a public perception standpoint, and that's not good for those workers or the country.
Come off the wall, no pun intended. Let me go back to the phone lines. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Robin calling from D.C. Hey, Robin. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Robin, are you there? Give me a call back if you can. Let's go to Tony calling from Capitol Heights. Tony, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I think it's a strategical move because President Trump, the heat is coming down on him tremendously. All these investigations and some dirt is popping up on him practically on a daily basis. So divert everybody's attention to the wall. I need my wall. I'm in, and shutting the government down and all that takes the attention away from all his dirt and all the things that they're about to prosecute him on.
Mm-hmm.
I think the man is about to be impeached, and I think that's what this strategy is about.
That's thank you, Tony. That's interesting. And here's another point to that point, Dave. So it's one thing if you and I are neighbors and I'm playing my music too loud when I have a cookout and my negotiation with you is you want me to turn the music down, but I say, what, instead of me turning my music down, why don't you and your family come to the cookout?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But that's just the only people that are really affected in that negotiation are you and me.
Right.
But when you, for example, when you were on the council or when you were a state senator, like Nancy Pelosi and like the president, you had a constituency.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make it more difficult when you have other people that you have to answer to as opposed to just you and the only thing that you're going to have to answer to is whether or not you want beef or pork ribs at the cookout?
Right. No, I think so. So what I would say to that, and this is where, you know, I have somewhat of a different perspective from Scott, but I agree with a lot of what he said. I think there's going to be a point. I think this is where the congresswoman was accurate, that there's going to be a point where people are going to say, end this now, right? And I think there will be calls. I mean, there's, look, politics is about affecting the pocketbook. And when this really gets deeper and deeper into the pocketbook and there are no other resources for people to sort of make amends for their livelihood, then there's going to be calls for both sides to sort of, look, you guys need to come together and end this. And this is why, like, my point is that the Congress has to step up. I think people need to call their representatives and say, all right, get something done. This is not just about, President Trump. And I agree with the earlier caller. When you have a different agenda outside of what you're trying to negotiate, then the negotiations are always going to break down. Mm-hmm. And so there's suspicion that the president has a different agenda outside this wall. And I think that it may be a disguise for other things that the president is concerned about. But nevertheless, I think then that the Congress has to step up, particularly the Senate has to step up and take a vote and put something on the president's desk. And that something should be what the bill that passed in the House.
Scott, when you are negotiating with prosecutors, what's the most difficult thing for you in dealing with them?
How my client is being charged. Mm-hmm. And how I resolve whether he or she takes a plea or not, and also what sentencing looks like. So, for example, I go in and I say, if my guy didn't do it, I try to convince the government that my client didn't do it. If my client has some exposure or some issue in regard to how he's being charged, I certainly concede that in private and say, what does that look like for you all from a charging document? If my client has something to offer the government that they don't have, then we certainly talk about that as well. But ultimately, if my client, for whatever reason, or I believe that taking a plea is really important, once we get done with the proffer, it's all about negotiating what he gets charged with and what he can get and what the prosecution is prepared to offer him to resolve this matter. You know, the government has a lot of pressure on them in criminal cases to plea individuals out to keep the court docket moving. They simply cannot try every case. And if my client is a key to another case or future cases, or they have to continue to move the cases along, then certainly I want the best deal possible. But at each juncture, I've got credibility and I've got my research and factual support or affidavits or witnesses to support whatever I'm communicating to the prosecutor, especially if I'm trying to settle the case, get my client the best deal, and allow him to get on with his life as quickly as possible, whether that means probation, whether that means a six-month term, whether that means a year, or whether it means that person doing some community service. It's what your strength is in negotiations. You got to be able to define that, and you got to define what the other side's strength is, and then you move forward. And that can take you down a lot of different paths depending on the facts and depending on the law.
But I think that Scott makes a very, very important point here, and I think there are two takeaways that I'm hearing from his point. Number one, you know who you have to negotiate with. So in this case, as Scott was talking about, I'm defending, someone who allegedly commits a crime. I know I'm working with the district attorney to either one, get rid of this thing, or number two, reduce the penalties associated with that crime.
Right.
If even those negotiations break down, right, well, then there's the courts. Right. And so then Scott says, hey, look, I have a strong case. I feel like my client is innocent. District attorney says, no, I think they're guilty. And they weigh down the courts. And there's a process even before with discovery and evidence and what have you, which may then halt the process even before it gets to the courts. So my point is that this shutdown is similar. There's a process. That process is being abated for a personal agenda that is holding 800,000 people at least and other residual folks hostage for then this budgetary item in the wall. And so that's You know, that's the thing that I think is most troubling. Our democracy is being held hostage in a way that we've never seen before. And like Scott was saying, and I think it's a great, you know, great analogy, the court system works because there is a process and everybody knows the process. And ultimately, you're going to get to some resolution. You may not like the resolution, but you're going to get to some resolution.
In
this case, there's no process to get at a resolution. And that is the problem. And shame on the president and shame on then the Senate in particular for holding these people hostage for not following the democratic process.
I need to take a break. But when we come back, I want to ask Scott about the politics of his job as it relates to defending a client. We may have justice on one scale, but depending on what year you may be defending this client could determine whether or not that client goes free, gets a few years, or gets locked up for decades. I'll explain what I mean on the other side of this break. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking about the art of the deal, negotiating amid the partial federal government shutdown. We'll be back in a moment. I'm on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about the art of negotiation, the art of the deal amid the partial federal government shutdown. Before the break, Scott, I was attempting to throw out in a scenario when it comes to negotiation and where you have to balance justice and the politics. So you're a veteran, a criminal defense attorney. 20 years ago, if you had a client who was arrested with a pound of marijuana because of the political climate 20 years ago, I'm sure the negotiation for that criminal defendant was considerably different when you compare that same offense, a pound of marijuana in January of 2018, and the political climate for that kind of offense now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. The politics is usually coming from the Department of Justice or the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. They prosecute federal and local crimes, at least for the most part here in the District of Columbia. Who's in the deal? Who's in the White House, if you will? Who's the Attorney General? I mean, if Attorney General Sessions is there and he has undone a lot of the policies in regard to marijuana or guns or how you prosecute white-collar criminal cases, you prosecute them to the max, and that's his policy, then certainly if I have a client or a corporation that is being charged or investigated, I've got to brief that client, whether it's the corporation or individual, about not only what they're facing, but from a policy standpoint, that the assistant U.S. attorney who we will engage with at some point is going to be fulfilling a policy that is a hard line on marijuana, for example. Under the prior Attorney General, Eric Holder, states didn't have to worry about the feds coming in and prosecuting them for marijuana sales, whether they were legal or due to medical marijuana. Now you know Sessions has left, and you know you've still got a Republican administration, and it's unclear until Bill Barr gets there. But the reality is, politics is always in the mix. It comes into play also with what judge did you draw in D.C. Superior Court or Federal Court? What's the history? My history with those judges, or what? Where did that judge come from? Did he come from the government's office, prosecutor's office, or did he come from a legal aid society, if you will, or the public defender's office? All of this goes into play. You see it when we pick juries, right? We all have our views on juries and how you read people and what their background is. Are they going to be conservative or liberal? Are they going to think, even to a gender basis, right? Do I want all women or do I want all men if I'm handling a sexual assault case, if you will? And based on my experience and based on their backgrounds, do I want them on the jury or not? So as a criminal defense lawyer or even a civil defense lawyer, you're constantly looking, guessing, if you will, based on your experience, how all of this is going to affect whether you try the case or not, whether you settle it, or whether you plea your person out. The one big difference here, when you talk about the government, and I agree with my colleague, the reality, though, is what's missing from this government shutdown equation is the fact that we don't have a court to go to.
Right.
You know, usually you criminal civil case, you know, if they can't settle, they don't want to give up the wall, then you go litigate the case. But as we say, nobody's afraid to try a case in the system. So you can go to court. Here, with the shutdown, you don't have that. But you have a lot of the similarities that David talked about, and certainly I just talked about.
And see, the other thing that I think has not been talked a lot about, Dave, is that we see that the relationship or lack thereof between President Trump and Nancy Pelosi is at best strained. Now, the president has spoken publicly about respecting her. We don't know whether or not she respects him. We certainly, it could be argued that she does not like him. Does the president like Nancy Pelosi? Well, does the president like anybody one day to the next? But for you as a former elected official, what part do relationships play in negotiation?
No, it's essential that you have a relationship of respect. Now, you as a senator, did I go to lunch with some of my Republican colleagues? Absolutely. And did we discuss a bill? Yes. I can remember I passed a major bill in the Senate that dealt with disabilities and more funding for disabled people. And the leader of the Republican Party did not like that bill. I went over to that leader. We went to lunch. I talked about the merits of the bill and what could that leader accept. And we worked out a deal and amendments that later on passed the Senate floor. And that's why we were able to get more funding for disabled people, right? But we respected each other. We respected what we were trying to do. We didn't have an outside agenda. And we proceeded with the business of governing. And we've seen this historically. I want to state an example, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tip O'Neill wrote that, you know, Ronald Reagan was one of the most, you know, unintelligible presidents that he ever had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever he thought about Ronald Reagan and Ronald Reagan thought about him, Ronald Reagan knew he had to go to the Speaker of the House and say, look, if I want, you know, more funding for the military, I want certain things, I've got to negotiate with Tip O'Neill. And Tip O'Neill knew that I have to negotiate with the president. So it's about respect, and those relationships are essential. And you cannot operate in a non-relational peace, especially when you're not calling in Nancy Pelosi and say, okay, look, Nancy, how do we resolve this? What is it going to take, Nancy? What is your caucus saying? You know, how do I get a bill on my desk where we both win?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have that right now. And so without that, then I don't know when this is going to halt. And I actually think that the only way that I certainly don't want to hear from Scott, that people begin to start making phone calls, particularly in Kentucky, which is one of the poorest states in the United States.
And where Mitch McConnell is from.
And where Mitch McConnell is from, and say, look, Mr. McConnell, we didn't put you there to sort of like take money out of our pockets. We need you to move and take up this bill. And that's why I think that's got to happen. And so I think the silver lining around this is that the people whose government this is has got to rise up and call their representatives and say, look, act like what we supposedly elected you for and get the job done.
You know, one of the other things, too, because we talked about, for example, with Dave, a former elected official in the negotiation, you know, in Annapolis on the county council. You know, Scott, you made some really great points about balancing justice and the politics of negotiating in the courtroom and outside. But here's the really big piece in these last couple of minutes. Both of you guys are old married guys. So, you know, I use the term old loosely. But, you know, is...
Well, I'm a grandfather, so I think...
me too.
I didn't know that, Scott. Okay.
So, you know, but when is negotiating with your spouse, do you use some of those same skills? And I... And I say that kind of tongue in cheek, but the reality is that relationships also require compromise and negotiation. Because Scott is laughing. You okay over there, Scott? Not gonna put you on the put you on the couch. You know, I'll let you start with that one. You know, you don't bring the courtroom to the living room, do you?
No, I'm actually on the road. I can speak freely, but I'm sure my wife's friends are listening hard. let me say this, because I know we only got a couple of minutes. Clearly, I've learned a lot since my first marriage, because I'm on my second one. And I don't recommend anybody litigate their way through marriage bully their way through marriage. It is the art of compromise, not the art of the deal. That's happy, right. Happy wife, happy life. It took me a while to figure that part out, but I ultimately did. But no, these negotiation tactics simply don't work at home, except in this sense. David talked about it's all relational, and it is, right? Now, these aren't business or political relationships. This is a loving relationship. This is a partnership relationship. If you got kids, it's a parental relationship, and you've got to get along. You're stronger together than you are apart. And you've got to make, each partner has to make sure that they are being heard, respected, and understood, even to the point where you repeat what their position is on some agreement or disagreement regarding the kids or money or what have you, right? Because people have to feel empowered in loving relationships. You're conceding a lot and compromising a lot as it is, but you got to use your love to keep each other strong. You can't use your love to make each other weak, which reminds me of the Stevie Wonder song. You know, which one I don't know. But
Dave, I'll let you have the last word.
No. I would say as someone who's been married to the happily married to the same woman for over 35 years and who I met at Howard University, and we dated for 7 years before we got married. So we're talking about 42 years of dating and being married to the same woman. What I recognize is her space, and she recognizes my space, and we recognize each other as co-equals in this relationship, right? And we recognize that this is about building character, right? And character and love. And so, in closing for all this, that you have to come to a place where you recognize that you value and that you can't do without, and you have a deep relationship with that person who has shaped you as he shapes you. And in this thing with Trump and the Democrats, there's a lack of value and lack of character in recognizing who they are and what they're about.
Great place in this relationship. Yeah, I'm keeping you off the couch there, Scott. Thank you.
Scott, it's good hearing from you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like a good frat brother to interview.
Hey,
right?
Without a doubt. David Harrington, A. Scott Bolden, thank you so much for enlightening us and talking to us tonight. We appreciate it. We'll be in touch.
Thank you.
The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Wednesday, January 23rd, 2019. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.